Today is April 27, 2017, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington. Coming up on the program, the narrow Turkish referendum victory revealing some economic concerns. Scientists report progress on malaria treatment tests. Experts, they're worried about a lack of new U.S. ambassadors around the world.
So it's perfectly possible that a large part of the delay is simply that those making the decisions are totally overloaded.
Also ahead, President Trump targeting federal education programs. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, 3 months into his administration, President Donald Trump has yet to nominate candidates to fill a large number of senior State Department positions in Washington and to serve as ambassadors at U.S. embassies around the world. Ambassadors are normally political appointees and are traditionally replaced under each new administration. But as VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain reports, this time the process is going slower than usual, with 181 of 188 ambassadorships still awaiting nominations.
With tensions escalating in North Korea and elsewhere, President Donald Trump has only had two new ambassadors confirmed and has nominated only five others. Still not nominated? A U.S. ambassador to South Korea or an assistant secretary of state for East Asian and Pacific Affairs? Brookings Institution's Thomas Wright says this lack of expertise is unprecedented and worrisome.
If you take, for instance, the recent summit with President Xi Jinping of China, there were very few Asia experts appointed to senior positions. Those people normally would be crucial in guiding that summit along. And so this, I think, is having a damaging effect now on an ongoing basis.
State Department spokesman Mark Toner this week sought to address some of those concerns.
I can assure everyone in this room and everyone in the United States and around the world that these are not vacancies, that there are senior State Department officials serving in acting capacities, but these folks are seasoned veterans of the Foreign Service and seasoned diplomats.
Asked why this administration is having more trouble nominating ambassadors than past ones, retired U.S. Ambassador Ron Newman weighed in.
There is a very small group in the White House that is controlling a lot of things. And there are some tensions within that group, but in addition to that, it's just small. So it's perfectly possible that a large part of the delay is simply that those making the decisions are totally overloaded.
Wright believes there are also political factors at work.
Particularly some people around Trump are intent on vengeance against people who opposed him in the campaign. And so they've ruled out any Republicans who criticized or opposed Trump during the election. But they have virtually nobody who's qualified for senior Senate confirmable positions, or very few people who actually supported him. And so we have a bit of a standoff.
With foreign policy challenges in Syria, Russia, and many other hotspots around the world, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson would likely welcome all the help he can get in having leadership positions filled. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Okay, well, on to the social media segment, and joining us is, as always, Andrew Pachewski, and he's here to tell us what is trending on the trend line today, and what have we got?
Well, sad news coming out of the Department of Defense, the announcement that two U.S. soldiers were killed in Afghanistan Wednesday night. The news coming out just today, killed in a battle against ISIS militants. So a lot of memorializing of their lives on social media. We don't know who they are yet. The names have not been released, but a lot of calls on social media as well to support service members fighting overseas. And many said that this is a reminder that even though the battles these men and women are fighting aren't necessarily making headlines every day, they are still going on, and they're overseas in many parts of the world fighting these battles. So very sad news about that, and one that's getting a lot of reaction on social media.
And do we know what they're saying? What are folks having to say about it?
Well, there's a lot of different opinions. You have people, of course, like we said, you know, memorializing, commemorating their lives, mourning their loss. You have people talking about war in general, anti-war sentiments being expressed, saying that it was a senseless loss of life for fighting overseas. And then people, again, saying that these battles continue on, that the fight against ISIS continues on, and people put their lives at risk literally every day, and they don't necessarily get that attention.
All right, so sad news there, but we move on to another segment on what is trending and something, what, Take Your Child to Work Day?
Yeah, I thought VOA was maybe on a hiring spree, hiring some young new staffers, but no, they're just
them today, yes.
The children of the folks that work here. It is Take Your Children to Work Day. Around the world, people are bringing their kids to work. A lot of people on social media posting pictures of their kids at work. Some people putting their kids to work, saying, you're going to sit at the desk and I'm going to have you go through these papers or do the, you know, giving them tasks to do.
Well, I was coming through the corridor here, and there were like four or five kids right in front of me, and I'm thinking, what's going on?
Yeah, I figured I was going to send one of them to do the social media segment, but no, it's... It's a lot of fun to have these little ones running around in all offices around the world, and they're having a lot of fun just up the way from us on Capitol Hill. House Speaker Paul Ryan was posing with the children of the congressional correspondents there in the briefing room. There was one picture that's going around social media of a youngster. I guess his father or mother is a photographer, and he's got a camera, and he's posing with the camera right below Paul Ryan trying to get his picture. So they're, again, putting the kids to work. And then another picture, the White House briefing room filled with children, inspiring some jokes saying that it's representative of the media. Other jokes, too, about Ivanka Trump working at the White House saying that every day is Take Your Child to Work Day in the Trump administration.
Of course.
And perhaps coincidentally, also trending today, if kids were in charge, hashtag if kids were in charge, I think it fits with Take Your Children to Work Day. Funny jokes like, you know, arguments at work would be settled by rock, paper, scissors. There would be nap time, which would be great. And again, this joke, they said they already have kids in charge. It's called Congress. So people making that joke.
You know, that could be appropriate, right?
Yeah, people not happy with the lawmakers up on Capitol Hill, and they're taking some jokes and pot shots at them.
What are they at, 85 or 90% disapproval rate up there somewhere?
That sounds maybe something like that. A bit low. I think it's usually more disapproval than that. But
yeah, my goodness. Not good. Okay. Andrew Palczewski, thank you very much. Social media guru. We'll see you here tomorrow, right?
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot.
This is Science in a Minute.
Albert Einstein once said, if the bee disappeared off the surface of the globe, then man would only have 4 years of life left. For a while now, beekeepers have been reporting that their honeybee populations have been dying off at increasingly rapid rates. According to an annual national survey, U.S.-based beekeepers lost 44% of their honeybee colonies from April 2015 to April 2016. A new study from researchers at Cornell University suggests that honeybee colonies are in danger due to lingering and wandering pesticides. Studying 120 pristine honeybee colonies, the researchers found that 17% of them had high levels of pesticide exposure. Another 73% were found to have lasting exposure to the pest killer. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Among the top stories in the world, two U.S. troops are killed in an anti-ISIS operation in Afghanistan. China eyes some tighter sanctions on North Korea. A major explosion near the Damascus International Airport. And a NASA spacecraft reaches uncharted territory between Saturn and its rings. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan eking out a narrow referendum victory, even though the country's industrial heartland and the main cities voted against him for the first time in his political career. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul that the loss of support coincides with an economic slowdown, which likely will be a central concern with presidential and general elections just 2 years away.
President Erdogan's referendum victory was bittersweet. For the first time, he lost in Turkey's main cities, including Istanbul, which has been his electoral power base since 1994. In the aftermath of his narrow win, he has ordered a party investigation into the vote. İnan Demir, an economist for Nomura Bank, points out that Erdogan's unprecedented electoral successes were achieved in a period of economic boom, but those halcyon days appear to be waning.
Currently, inflation rate is at 11.3%, and it is expected to increase further to around 12% in the coming months. It would constitute highest inflation rate since before the global financial crisis in 2009. And also, unemployment rate is also at multi-year highs. So we're talking about a significant acceleration in inflation and unemployment rate.
The impact of the economic slowdown has been felt most in Western Turkey, where more than 70% of its economic production is located, and most closely linked to European markets. While the Turkish economy is predicted to grow faster than that of Europe, it's still below the rate needed to absorb new entrants into the labour market. A striking development of the referendum was the youth vote overwhelmingly voting no, bucking its traditionally stalwart support for Erdogan. Atilla Yeşilada, a political consultant with Global Source Partners, says that should deeply concern the president.
Youth unemployment is affecting the first-time vote. Youth unemployment ratio was 25% in the last data. 58% of first-time voters voted no. According to OECD research, Turkish students are the unhappiest in the world, with 72% of them saying that they're very unhappy with the current conditions. So given Turkey's very high rate of young population, up to 6% of the voters in the next election cycle, which starts in March 2019, would be first-time voters, which in my view is slipping from their grasp.
2019 is scheduled for an unprecedented three polls of local, general and presidential elections. In the run-up to the referendum, the government launched major programs of cheap loans for businesses, job creation schemes, and the ramping up of massive public works projects. Economist Demir claims that with both individuals and private companies racked with debt, more state intervention is likely.
Turkey will find it difficult to sustain that debt-fueled growth. That's why I think the public sector will play a growing role in supporting economic activity going forward. Personally, I expect elections to be held earlier than the current schedule. I wouldn't be surprised if we see elections by this time next year. So I think it can be sustained until that time.
The pressure to call early elections will deepen worries about how the government will fund its growing economic and financial programs. Given that the bedrock of Erdogan's electoral success has been built on economic prosperity, the continuation and trajectory of those programs ultimately could determine his fate. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Well, some new changes in the U.S. education system could be underway as President Donald Trump signs an executive order directing the U.S. Department of Education to identify federal rules that he says interfere with state and local government control of public schools. As VOA's Greg Flakus reports, the move is part of an overall effort to reduce the size, the cost, and the reach of the U.S. central government.
In a brief White House ceremony, President Trump signed the executive order that calls for a 300-day review of all federal education rules, regulations, and mandates to eliminate any that impede state and local control over public schools.
The executive order I'm signing today is another critical step to restoring local control, which is so important.
The president said previous administrations had wrongfully forced states and schools to comply with federal whims.
But we know that local communities do it best and know it best. The time has come to empower parents and teachers to make the decisions that help their students achieve success.
The executive order on education follows one the president signed Monday that requires all federal agencies to develop a list of recommendations for programs that can be eliminated. It's also expected to substantially reduce the power and size of the Department of Education and further the implementation of a recently passed law that scaled back federal mandates established under President Barack Obama, something Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos fully supports.
Each state and each school have different challenges, and each individual student has unique needs. Our solutions should be as varied as the students we serve.
Close your eyes.
The Obama administration used federal mandates and rules to promote uniform standards in education and testing across the nation and to prevent any form of discrimination against students for their race, religion, sexual orientation, or identity. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Well, scientists at the University of Cape Town in South Africa say they have tested a new experimental drug that they believe could not only treat but also eradicate malaria, a deadly disease that strikes 200 million people each year. The compounds work successfully in mice and monkeys, but if it proves successful in humans, it could become a significant breakthrough in the treatment of the deadly disease. Zlata Tahoke has more.
Experiments by the university's Drug Discovery and Development Center found that the compound called MMV-048 blocks the parasite that causes malaria across its multiple life stages, interrupting the infection cycle. This is important because the parasite has become resistant to conventional drugs, says the center's director, Kelly Chibali.
This is the last line of defense against the parasite. So although there's been improvement and a good outlook in terms of reduction in number of deaths and number of infections, this could very easily swing the opposite direction and the situation could actually get worse if we do not address resistance by coming up with new drugs that are able to circumvent the current drug resistance, but also new drugs that actually offer the possibility to eradicate malaria in the future.
Chibali says in animal trials, a single dose compound cured 100% of mice that were infected with malaria, and it protected monkeys from getting infected. If the tests prove successful with humans, the drug could be a huge breakthrough in the treatment and prevention of malaria, a mosquito-borne disease that killed 429,000 people in 2015. Most of them children in sub-Saharan Africa.
So what we have done in the last 3 years since the announcement was in 2012 is that we have taken this to phase one human clinical trials. And of course, there is a long way to go. The potential that this compound offers is more than just the potential to impact malaria control, but also the potential to impact eradication because it's able to block transmission.
The South African scientist says tests on a potential cure for malaria have attracted international interest, including funding and scientific contributions by experts from around the world. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Well, how far would you go to protect your children? And what if they had done something horrible and other people had been hurt? These are some of the questions that come up in a new movie starring Golden Globe winner Richard Gere and Laura Linney, The Dinner. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the thriller revolves around choices and their consequences for two brothers.
So what's the subject at hand?
You know what it is.
It's about the boys.
How much do you know?
How much do you know?
He's gonna turn us in. He's gonna turn us in, I know.
These boys have committed a horrific crime.
Stan Lohman is a popular congressman running for governor. He invites his troubled younger brother Paul and his wife Claire to join him and his wife for dinner at an expensive restaurant. Stan, played by Richard Gere, and Paul, played by Oscar nominee Steve Coogan, have been estranged for years, but their sons are best friends. However, the two teenage boys have committed a terrible crime that might never be found out. The dinner is intended to decide what to do about that. Richard Gere says the film looks at the nuances of life. What is the right thing to do, and who defines what's right and wrong, especially when several people have legitimate arguments?
All of them are defensible, and all of them are understandable. And depending on and conditions, could follow any one of those arguments. And that's our world today. This is a world of subtle mental and emotional processes. Unlike the president we have right now, the gray area is where we actually live. So there's no right and wrong in almost any situation in our lives.
The film is based on a novel by Herman Koch. Director Oren Moverman, who also wrote and directed Time Out of Mind, Rampart, and The Messenger, wrote the screenplay. He says The Dinner wrestles with what it means to be human.
I think there's a fundamental question that's being asked in the world that we live in right now, and with the technology that we have, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to acknowledge the humanity of others? And that's really what the, you know, conversation that's coming out of this movie is about.
Rebecca Hall plays Gere's second wife, Caitlin, who is doing her best to be a mother to Gere's three children, none of which is hers. Hall says the movie shows how family dramas can have far-reaching consequences.
They're all essentially horrible people and good people at the same time. And I think that gray area is challenging to us because we all want to exist in our bubbles and assume that the people outside the bubbles are the ones who are doing the wrong thing. So to present a story that challenges your sense of black and white, right and wrong, I think is important.
Oscar nominee Laura Linney plays Claire, the wife of retired schoolteacher Paul Lohman and the mother of one of the teenaged boys. Linney says she doesn't know how she would react under similar circumstances.
I hope I would know how I would behave. I would love to say that I would take what I feel is the ethical way to go. But I think until you're actually in that situation, I don't know what primal desire comes through. I don't think I'm a Claire, but I'm sure there's a little bit of Claire in all of us, as there is, hopefully, you know, a little bit of Richard's character in all of us as well.
The Dinner also stars Oscar nominee Chloe Sevigny as Barbara Lohman, Stan's ex-wife, and the mother of his children. The film is playing at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York and is set for wide release May 5th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
All right, David, thank you very much. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. You can like us on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States-Japan alliance is the cornerstone of peace, prosperity, and freedom in the Asia-Pacific, said Vice President Mike Pence on his recent visit there. Under President Donald Trump, the United States stands unwavering in our alliance and unyielding in our resolve to defend all that we have built together over these generations. The United States will strengthen its presence in the Asia-Pacific, said Mr. Pence. Japan will assume a larger role and responsibility in our alliance in the years ahead, and both of our nations will continue to expand our cooperation for our common defense. Together, said Mr. Pence, we will defend the rules-based order upon which the region's progress, past and future, depends. We will protect the freedom of navigation and overflight and other lawful uses of the sea, in the South China Sea and elsewhere. And we will ensure the unimpeded flow of lawful commerce on the seven seas. Even now, there are storm clouds gathering in the region as regards North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons. It is the most dangerous and urgent threat to peace and security of the Asia-Pacific, said Mr. Pence. For more than two decades, the United States and its allies have worked to peacefully dismantle North Korea's nuclear program and alleviate the suffering of its people. But at every step of the way, North Korea answered these overtures with willful deception, with broken promises, and nuclear and missile tests. As President Trump has made clear, the era of strategic patience is over. The United States will continue to work diligently with Japan, our allies across the region, China, and the wider world to bring economic and diplomatic pressure to bear on the regime in North Korea. and we will do so until they abandon their nuclear and ballistic missile programs, said Vice President Pence. In the meantime, all options are on the table. And those who would challenge American resolve, said Mr. Pence, should know that the U.S. will defeat any attack and meet any use of conventional or nuclear weapons with an overwhelming and effective American response. The United States of America will always seek peace, but under President Trump, the shield stands guard and the sword stands ready.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.